My brother keeps a human head in his closet. I hope I don't end up that way.
This thing, it's gonna follow you. Somebody gave it to me. And I passed it to you. It could look like someone you know, or it could be a stranger in a crowd. It could look like anyone.
Help! Santa Claus only brings presents to them that's been good all year. To the ones that ain't done nothing naughty. All the other ones. All the naughty ones. He punishes you. See Santa Claus tonight, you better run, boy. You better run for your life.
Bring me one of those chickens.
You got money to pay for it?
You paid for it.
No, but we're the king's men. So, you got money?
Not a penny. I'll still take that chicken.
You don't seem to understand the situation.
I understand that if any more words come pouring out your mouth, I'm going to have to eat every chicken in this room.
You lived your life for the king. You're gonna die for some chickens.
Someone is.
The symbol is associated with a pagan deity named Bagul. He consumes the souls of human children. Early Christians believed that Bagul actually lived in the images themselves and that they were gateways into his realm.
I am seriously positive these were not here. How would we have, just made a campsite in between three piles of rocks just by coincidence?
You don't think this is strange?
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me, well, actually, this is a special book episode, so it's a couple of different co-hosts in the state of Virginia.
Hey, this is Barrett.
Barrett, how's it going, man?
It's going well.
Excellent. And in the state of Missouri?
Hi, this is Kevin.
Kevin, how are you?
Groovy. I'm doing all right. Doing all right. Managing.
All right. And you're 1 hour behind us because you're in Central Time and me and Barrett on Eastern Standard Time. We're supposed to have another co-host, Abe from Massachusetts, but he is unfortunately on AWOL, which is somewhat surprising because he was promoting this episode big on the regular episodes of Dark Discussions, even our last recording. For folks who are interested, we are recording this on May 19th, 2020. So just for folks who follow that, because I know we do have some listeners such as someone named Pam, who always is curious, who we are for those who are new to the podcast. Well, Dark Discussions is a podcast that basically talks genre films mostly, though this is a special edition of the book episode. But basically we talk about sci-fi, fantasy, horror, thriller, techno thriller, mystery, grindhouse, art house, midnight movies, drive-in films, cult films, and things of that nature, and sometimes even foreign art house films. Also, you can find us. You can find us pretty much anywhere podcasts are found. Just search for Dark Discussions Podcast on your favorite podcast provider. If you don't find it there, just go to your second favorite podcast provider, and it should be there. So places such as Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, iHeartRadio, wherever podcasts are found. Also, we have a website, Dark Discussions Podcast. Website is www.darkdiscussions.com. On the website, you can find basically all the episodes as well. There's also a link to our email, which is darkdiscussions@aol.com. So if you want to send us an email, we will read your email on the podcast. So anything you have of interest, whether it's your opinion of our topic tonight or prior topics or anything horror-related or genre-related, superheroes, anything of that nature, just send it over. Also, you can go to Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, where we have lot of discussion on various topics, genre related. So, like, for example, Westworld just wrapped up. There's some discussions on that. Right now they're talking about AMC theaters and theaters being closed. Talks all sorts of things, genre. Also, we have a Patreon, basically at the top of the darkdiscussions.com website. There's a link directly to Patreon, but you can also just go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions, and you can help the podcast. The podcast is not something we're asking for money, but it is expensive. We do run in the red because we do have fees to pay for our server and various other things. And for every $5 you donate to the podcast each month, you get to choose a topic for us to possibly do. So basically anybody who donates say $15, you could choose three different films, such as Nightmare on Elm Street, I Spit on Your Grave, or Invasion of the Body Snatchers, or you could choose Invasion of Body Snatchers three times. And then what happens is it all goes into a figurative hat where each quarter, so the end of the each quarter, we pull randomly from our spreadsheet of Patreon picks, and then we will do an episode, and your donations are greatly appreciated. So that's pretty much who we are and whatnot for new listeners and those who know us. All right, so I guess we can discuss just a couple of things before we get into our topic. Anybody have anything they wanted to bring up? It's been a while since our last podcast. We'll have some time at the end of the episode to discuss other horror and genre related things, but any of you, Barrett or Kevin, that want to bring up anything beforehand?
Nothing beforehand.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. We can get into more specifics after. So the book episode, what is this book episode? Barrett, why don't you let everybody know what a book episode is? Because most people are familiar with Dark Discussions as a movie review and critique show.
Well, a book episode, we decide on something we're going to read, and then we will give it a good review and walkthrough.
Yep, exactly. So just like movies, what we'll critique and review and discuss symbolism and all that. So it's kind of spoiler-like, but I mean, most of these stories that we do on the book episodes are very old. When I say very old, 20 years old, or in this case, almost 100 years old for the story that we're going to discuss tonight. So, Kevin Letts, why don't you let everybody know what story we are going to discuss tonight?
Tonight, we are going to discuss H.P. Lovecraft's Whisperer in the Darkness.
That's right. Whisperer in the Darkness is one of his longer stories. It's actually considered a novella, 26,000 words, which is pretty big for a quote-unquote short story. It was actually written in 1930 and released in the magazine Weird Tales in 1931. Some folks call it horror, some call it sci-fi, but it's probably both.
Yeah, I'd call it both.
Yeah, I would too. Yeah, same here. It basically takes place in mostly in Vermont. Well, it takes place through letters mostly, and then it takes place mostly in Vermont afterwards. All the locations are pretty real. Most of them are everything in Vermont is real except for Dark Mountain. The Green Mountains do exist. All the towns that are named exist. Actually all three states, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Vermont, except, of course, Arkham, which is the only false village or town that's listed in the book or novella. I'm not actually too far from a number of these towns that are named, because there's the train trip from Boston to basically Brattleboro, and that they talk about a lot in this story, and all the towns: Winchendon, Massachusetts, Keene, New Hampshire, Brattleboro, Vermont, are all fairly close to where I live. And then Bellows Falls, also in Vermont, is very close to where I live. And then Townsend, Vermont, which is where the main plot of the story takes place, actually does exist. There is a Dark Mountain board game store in Springfield, Vermont, which is very close to Townsend, Vermont, named after, obviously, the Dark Mountain, which is the fake mountain that doesn't exist, that's in the town of Townsend, which does exist, if that makes any sense. So I guess we can go around and discuss what we thought about the story and how we first heard about it and all that. So why don't we start with you, Barrett?
I've loved Lovecraft forever. So I've always been off and on reading his stories. I read this one probably 20 years ago, maybe a little longer. And I've read it several times since. I've read it now twice for this episode. And was and really looking forward to talking about it.
All right, very good. Now, Kevin, what about yourself? Have you, what did you think of this story, and where did you first hear about it? And when was the first time you ever read it? And maybe you've only listened to it on audiobook, or only listened or slash read it once. I don't know. Let's hear what you have.
Let's see. Well, this book, I guess you could say I am a recent Lovecraftian fan. I say within the last 5-6 years or so have I really started to listen to the stories. A lot of times I do better, especially when it comes to stories, I do better listening than I do actually reading them. So that's why I find myself listening, especially while I'm at work. I will listen to, I have an audible.com account, or I will listen to people do their rendering of this stories, excuse me, on YouTube. Like this guy that does Horror Babble, does an excellent job of presenting these stories, reading these stories, and it's just a fantastic job. Now, I first heard of this, I don't know, because usually when I hear people talk about Lovecraft, this is one of the first. Well, I mean, obviously, after Cthulhu, this is one of the first stories that rolled off their lips, you know, saying that how, you know, it's a really, really good story. That's usually one of the more popular ones. But and there's a good reason for it, because I have listened to this several times, both from Audible and from Horror Babble on YouTube. And it's a fantastic story. I've seen one attempt at making this into a drama, like a TV, like a movie. And the one that I saw, I mean, it was definitely low budget. I didn't like how they ended it, but it was pretty decent. And then there's another one. Actually, we talked about it a couple days ago before all this. We were searching on YouTube for different you know, movie adaptations of this. And I'd like to see, now that we're going through this, I'd like to see how they did that in the movies.
Now, the one you saw, the adaption you did see, does it follow the story well, or does it take a lot of liberties?
It was, it may have been like 2 years ago when I saw it. I'm not, or early last year. And the ending, they changed the ending. Okay, before we go into it, you know, before we get into the story, all I can just say is they changed the ending, and I was not very, I mean, I was not happy with how they did that. But I mean, the rest of the story I thought was pretty, the rest of the movie and how they led up to it, I thought was pretty good.
Very good, very good. All right, sounds good. Yeah, for me, the first time I ever heard of the story, it was actually when I was in college. I took the horror story class, it's called. It was called Horror Story, and it was like basically a English lit or just a literature class, I should say, based on the horror story from the Castle of Otranto all the way up to the time of Lovecraft. And Lovecraft was one of the authors of note that was some of the assignments. And I always noticed that Whisper in the Dark, or Whisper in Darkness, or actually the full title, the full title is The Whisper in Darkness, was one of the many stories in the book I had to buy at the college a store for the class. And Whisper in Darkness was one of the stories. But I don't believe it was one of the stories that we had to read, because it was one of the longer ones. So what happened was I had never read it until maybe about 8 years ago, when I decided to pull off my four Arkham books, Arkham House books, off the bookshelf. Basically, they're the official Lovecraft stories, though many of them are in the public domain, the official print for his estate. And Arthur Durloff, who was the person that worked his estate for years prior to his passing, was Arkham House. So I have those editions. And so I decided to read those books. And I got through the first two. I never read the last two. And the first two are the ones with all the most popular stories. And Whisper in the Darkness was in the first book. And it was actually one of my favorite stories in the anthology, or collection, I should say. It was very original, and I like what we were talking about earlier, how it's had a lot of science fiction aspects into it compared to some of his other stories. But generally, it scared the hell out of me at points, first time read. And so I always had, when people asked me for Lovecraft stories, it was one of the ones I would always recommend. It's a pretty solid story. Just like all his stories, though, after you read them once, they're not as exciting after you read them the one time, because you already know what's going to happen. But, the first time reading is pretty phenomenal. So that's my experience with the story. And I actually read it twice more in the past 2 months, because we were supposed to record this 2 months ago and then this time here. So I read it two more times. So I've read it three total. All right. Sounds good. So how do we want to get into this story and explain it? Who wants to set it up? All right. I guess I will, since I hear silence. basically, there's a flood in 1927 in Vermont. They call it the Great Flood. So many deaths, things like that. Rivers overflow and rain and all that. And so some smaller towns in Vermont, basically it's the southeast corner of Vermont where Massachusetts and New Hampshire and Vermont meet. A lot of deaths. Bodies would float on the river, and in some cases, there were bodies that were bloated or didn't look human, and some people said they were just cows or animals that have become bloated due to being dead and floating in the water for days, but other people were convinced they were something else. And what happened is, since there was no internet back in the 1920s and 30s, people would write daily to local journals and newspapers, and there'd be whole sections of basically paper blogs where people would write their stories and comment, and these used to come out every other week or whatever. And what happens is, a professor at Miskatonic University, which is in Arkham, Massachusetts, so not too far from Cape Ann, Massachusetts, this professor, Albert Wilmarth, who is a professor of folklore, gets a hold of a lot of these magazines from Vermont, and sees these weird stories about bodies that were unhuman or non-animal that were floating in the rivers and the floods. And so he decides to get involved with these stories by writing his own pieces and sending them through train to Vermont, where they're published, and he has debates with the locals in Vermont. That's pretty much the setup, I think, right?
Yeah, that's a pretty good setup.
Yeah, pretty much. Actually, I mean, he kind of starts off, you know, when he's hearing about all these stories, he says, you know, people are not taking his work serious, his subject seriously, but they're giving it more attention. And I remember him mentioning how he was glad that people are actually starting to pay attention to his studying more, because mostly people just kind of said, you know, you're just kind of myths and legends. And now that, you know, you hear these myths and legends, you know, starting to come up, people are actually asking him for his opinion, you know, like he is an authority on something. And he's kind of enjoying the limelight. He is enjoying the limelight.
Yeah, that is true. That's true. And he explains what he thinks is going on. And basically, he actually even uses the author, Arthur Makem, who's a really great English author that actually inspired Lovecraft, and was a author that I was going to recommend as possible topics for future book episodes, because he writes mini novella type stuff too. And Arthur Makem is mentioned actually in the story by this professor, saying that, these creatures are more apt to be what Arthur Makem was writing. And basically, Arthur Makem used to write about dwarfs and fairies and all those type of things that people would in the British Isles would think, you know, when things got lost or people disappeared or whatever, it was the fairy folk or the dwarfs or whatever. And so Arthur Makem wrote all these short fiction in about the 1880s or whatever, talking about how maybe those creatures were true and that people were getting attacked or kidnapped or murdered by these non-human intelligent entities that lived in the woods that people thought were folklore, but they actually existed. And so what this author, or I should say not this author, this professor, he talks about how he thinks that it's probably most likely just, like I stated, cows or people who have become bloated from laying in the water for weeks. But the locals of Vermont, at least the uneducated folk, and this is Lovecraft's writing, not me talking about Vermont people, would be, the uneducated folk, rednecks, whatever you want to call them, who would just come to the common denominator of thinking everything is supernatural or monsters or whatever, and not use science and logic and intellect to determine or explain what they think is actually in the rivers. So that's I think that's right. What about you, Barrett? What do you got to say? You haven't said
I was going to say that I didn't want to break into what you were saying, but I was going to say that's one of the strong points about Lovecraft is how he can sprinkle in the real with the unreal, and, you know, adding in an author that he knew, and it just kind of makes the story more solid.
Yeah, indeed. Barrett, what did you think of the logical setting of how this folklore professor would, as Kevin said, get limelight because now he has an audience, and he gets to talk about folklore and all that, and then also his own personal diary or discussion with us, the reader, what he actually thinks of the locals and their, I guess, folklore or beliefs when he's, I guess,
go from being a pretty much a total skeptic, and as he slowly approaches the reality, he realizes that his skepticism is probably wrong. And at some point, he realizes that he can't really tell a whole lot of people about it either later on, you know. So it's an interesting thing to see or read about, whatever.
Right, or dilemma, right? Dilemma?
Yeah, his change of character from being a total skeptic to not skeptical at all.
Yeah, I mean, the funny part also is that now that he's authority, you can kind of read he's starting to get a little arrogant.
Yeah.
Do you guys think he is... Well, yeah, I mean, he's definitely a Brahim bourgeois Bostonian who comes right out and says that most of these Vermont folk are I guess rednecks. I mean, that's the best term I can say. Mountain folk, uneducated, silly folk. And so you're definitely right. He's definitely, if not narcissistic, he's definitely a snob, right? I mean,
well, he's even a snob to people, like even in the university, because people who are reading his stuff are arguing with him, or at least saying, hey, do you think it could be this, do you think it could be that, or reminds me of that. And he's kind of, I don't remember any of the quotes, but you can just kind of hear it, you know, even through the letters. He's just like, oh man, you know, these people don't know what they're talking about. And, you know, and I think that's part of the skepticism too, is that he's arrogant, but he's also skeptic. It's like, look, I don't know what these people are seeing. It's not these creatures. These are myths. These aren't real. These are just myths. And so people are taking the local lore and putting and tying it into these dead carcasses that they're seeing.
Sure. Yeah, and to be honest, he's technically right. I mean, obviously, in the real world, right, there's no such thing as monsters or whatever. So technically, everything he says is correct. But the problem is the way he feels about the people he's talking to, which is, instead of saying that they're just, you know, simple folk who are into the Native American folklore and their own folklore from their grandparents that came from Scotland, Ireland, England, and France. He's basically poo-pooing them instead of just as if they're, I guess, dumb rather than misinformed, right? Am I right to think that? What about you, Barrett? Do you think I'm right to think that he looks at these folk as dumb, or is he really looking at them as ignorant fools, or is he looking at them as just misinformed?
I wouldn't say that he thinks they're dumb. Maybe a little ignorant, maybe a little sheltered from the real world as he sees it. But I don't think he thinks they're dumb.
Fair enough. I mean they're country folk. And back in 1925, when your only communication is letters and reading papers, obviously you're more apt to be more superstitious than, say, or not as worldly as, say, folks of today, or a guy that lives just outside of Boston and is a university professor. So I would agree with that they're definitely not stupid folk that he's arguing with. And maybe you're right. Maybe he's just arrogant, as you said, Kevin, and not a bigot against them or whatever. Now, let's see. What do we want to talk about next? I guess we can get into. I did mention a little bit. Yeah. So he does bring up not only the European folklore of the settlers of southeastern Vermont, which basically, again, are mostly French, English, Irish, and Scottish. But he also brings up the native folk, too, the Native Americans or Indians, if you prefer, and talks about them and how there's these areas of this part of Vermont, whether it was the Indian or whether it was the European settlers, that they would settle in various parts of the town, but the further you left downtown, obviously the more remote you became. And in this part of the country, specifically Vermont, you suddenly hit a wall of mountains, the Green Mountains. And these Green Mountains are obviously harder to traverse. And the best thing to do would be to go around them. And so when you hit the Green Mountains, people didn't bother settling them, whether it was the Indians or whether it was the Europeans. And so they began to become less frequented. And in some cases, whether it was Indians or just local farmers, would say that these areas are cursed because people would go in and get lost and whatever. And as generation and generation passed down, people would just avoid those areas and not go there because it's so remote and people have been lost or whatever. It was just considered a bad area to go to. Did I get that right, do you think?
Yeah, it's an area people don't go to, and I think because it's got that superstitious feel to it.
A little bit like the cemetery area, Pet Cemetery.
Yeah.
You know, that was an area that the Native Americans are like, I ain't going there.
Right.
Yeah, on the other side of the cemetery. Now, we do have Abe from Massachusetts who just joined us.
Right.
Hi, Abe.
Hey, guys. Abe.
Now, Abe. We're talking about, obviously the story that is our topic tonight. And the part we're talking about now is, just outside of Townsend, Vermont, where the story takes place and the area on that basically, there's a mountain called Dark Mountain that, mm-hmm. Folks have basically avoided because, and I think you heard most of what I was saying. What's your thoughts on that? And, generation to generation, people just never bother going, and eventually it just gets a bad name because people got lost or whatever.
It's a very popular staple of horror, you know, that place that you don't go, you know, near, you know, whether it's that kind of valley or this, in the case, this mountain or that old house on the street or, as you guys mentioned, at cemetery with the burial grounds and stuff like that. There's always that place where, as humans, we fear crossing over into it because whether it's from just almost like a, I would almost say hereditary sort of way passed down where people start saying that's a bad place, don't go there, even though you don't really know exactly why. There's always that kind of almost like a almost primal feeling, though, that even if you don't completely be knowledgeable of why, it's also the it's like a gut feeling. And that's how I go with this out of this place of Dark Mountain, is that even if people are not completely as knowledgeable about it, as the locals are, something like that, there's always a sense that it's a place where it's best not to tread. And in horror, that has always been, you know, a very important element on playing with human fear of the unknown, or that place where we dared not cross.
Now, I like how you both... Or a handful of you guys have mentioned Pet Cemetery, because I didn't even think of that connection. But as you mentioned, Stephen King and Pet Cemetery, where it was originally set up by the Native Indians, American Indians, and then the local town, Yankees and Frenchmen that lived in the town, would have the same folklore or concerns of the Pet Cemetery, because as the Indians mingle with the Europeans, and then eventually the two merge and their cultures or folklore kind of merge with it. This is the same way, because Lovecraft specifically talks about in this story, the lead character, Albert Wilmoth talks about the folklore of the Indians and then the folklore of the Europeans and how they basically say the same thing about Dark Mountain and that general area and whatnot. Anybody think that is kind of coincidental? Do you think Stephen King got that idea possibly reading this story, or is it just a trope that happens in horror, do you think, or horror or thriller?
I think he got a lot of his ideas from
Lovecraft. I imagine. I honestly think a lot of horror writers have in some way.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's a lot of the things that we see and still today but in the horror genre, Lovecraft had helped plant the seeds. And whether it's one born from another, they're seen again and again. And yeah, I wouldn't doubt it one bit if Cthulhu gave King a few bites on the brain in terms of the writings, whatever spooky story he had in mind. And, because one thing I always about King a lot is that he loved always playing with some kind of forbidden power that people try to control but always fail to. Pet Sematary being one. There is
Jerusalem's Lot. Not the real Lot, but the short story Jerusalem's Lot is very Lovecraftian.
Mm-hmm. From what I heard, I never had a chance to read that one. I read, because I've only read the actual novel, but that makes sense. And not to mention one of his famous characters, Pennywise, the clown, falls very heavy into the Eldritch sort of lore.
That's true. Yeah, like a great old one in a sense. Now, Kevin, you were the one that actually brought up Pet Sematary first. Did you bring that up because you saw that, if not coincidence, relationship where in this story here, just like in Pet Sematary, you have the native folklore, the Indian folklore, and then you have the farmers in local towns folklore of the European settlers and how it merges together, just like in Pet Sematary. Is that why you brought that up?
Yeah, I mean, it just came to me as we were, I mean, Pet Sematary wasn't, Pet Sematary really wasn't on my mind until we were talking about it tonight, and then it kind of dawned on me.
Yeah, that was a good reference, because, I didn't even think of that either until you brought it up. And this story, there's a whole 3 to 5 pages that were the author, or I should say lead character, Albert Wilmoth, who's talking to basically us in first person, talks all about the folklore and the Native Americans and the European settlers and how they both kind of shunned Dark Mountain originally because it was just hard to get at and use because it's just wilderness. Never mind people beginning to disappear and then eventually just shunning it for that reason. As folks may know, I mean, that's pretty much like that everywhere in the United States where there's still areas of the entire country, whether it's the Nevada desert or New Mexico desert or the Green Mountains even to this day and that part of Vermont. Or anywhere else, you can think of, are not inhabited by anybody to this day because either folks just haven't moved there yet, or it's just not feasible or worth settling on because of its remoteness. And so the Green Mountains, even today, 100 years later, are still just like that, where all the towns are in the valleys and whatever, and then as you climb up the slope, it's complete wilderness, and you'll hit moose and bear and coyotes and so forth. So I guess the next thing we probably want to talk about is Henry Akeley and his letter to the Miskatonic professor Albert Wilmoth and really starts the story, the main part of the story, because the first third of the story is really the setup and the folklore and the communication in the newspapers and all that other stuff about what's going on with the Vermont floods and so forth. But then Albert Wilmoth gets this letter from Henry Akeley from Townsend, Vermont. Who wants to set this up and discuss what this letter is and who Henry Akeley is and why Albert Wilmoth is interested with Henry Akeley, unlike the regular working class farmers and whatnot that he's been communicating with prior?
Well,
one
thing I know, I mean, Akeley himself, he's been writing and he's been also showing, well, not showing yet, but he was writing and saying, hey, look, you know, I'm seeing this stuff and I'm hearing these voices in the woods, you know. And at first the professor just kind of blew it off, or not really blew it off, but just said, okay, you know, he really didn't really think about too much. But then he noticed that the way Akeley was writing and all that, it's like, wait a minute, what happened was, is that he took him a little bit more seriously, or at least gave him more attention, because Akeley's educated.
Yeah. He's an academic.
He's an academic. He's not a local yokel, you know, he's not a, you know, a backwoods hick. He's actually somebody with an education, and at being a professor, he respects that. And then later on, you know, he says, look, I've got these things going on, and I've got these, and he shows pictures and all that, and he's starting to bring out proof, or at least evidence. And so this is really starting, it's one of those, yeah, I'm starting to agree with you, but I can't make that public yet.
Yeah, and what's really interesting is that, as you mentioned, that because Akeley is an academic, this professor even bothers listening in the first place. And, you know, it kind of plays into more of how the knowledge of what man possesses is always considered a thing of great value. Yet, the more knowledge that you obtain in these stories, the greater danger that is posed. As we see later on of Akeley. Akeley's ordeal reminds me a lot of those kind of stories where someone's trying to prove of UFOs or have videos of ghosts and stuff like that, and they're trying to prove that it's actually happening and stuff like that. But this is more done with really detailed letters and with a couple of sound recordings, but for the most part, he leads it to the imaginations through his descriptions of, you know, what has been transpiring at his residence on Dark Mountain.
Right. Also, I like how Akeley, when he writes to Wilmoth, he starts out that privately, I agree with the people that you're arguing with, meaning the Hicks, or whatever you want to call them, but publicly, privately, he agrees with I think I had it right the first time.
You had it right the first time.
Yeah, I had it right the first time. but publicly, he'll agree with the professor, because otherwise he'll look like a fool. And basically what it is, it's kind of interesting, because it's kind of how it is even today. And again, this is like I use as a example, this communications in these journals and newspapers back in 1920s and 1930s were the quote unquote internet of that era. And he's basically saying, Akeley is basically saying that even though I agree with the Hicks publicly, I'll never say it because I don't want to be attacked. You know, I mean, we see that now where people say that all the time. I get emails all the time from people saying, oh, Phil, I agree with you 100%, but I'll never say it publicly because then I'll get blocked on Facebook or whatever, because there's so much polarization. And in this sense here, as you said, Abe, this is kind of like ghost stories or UFOs or all that stuff, where you have people who will just be considered kooks. And Akeley, Henry Akeley, being a prominent family in the greater Brattleboro, Bellows Fall area of Vermont, he obviously does not want to be known as the local flake, since he has a reputation and a name to hold. But he does say in the letter, I actually disagree with you, Professor, and these are the reasons why. And he begins with like Kevin and you, Abe, said, pictures and things of that nature. And then he talks about how he's heard voices and whatnot, and we'll discuss some of those in a second. But before we do, what about you, Barrett? What did you think about all that, about Akeley's letter and how he privately and publicly, how he represents himself?
I liked how he approached it, and it got Wilmarth to listen to him by doing that. And they were able to have a good discussion, and he started sending him evidence for Wilmarth to look at, which was more compelling. And by starting it out that way, he made it so that Wilmarth would be more open to hearing what he had to say. Because publicly he would have been a skeptic, but after what he'd experienced, he wasn't. So he starts sending all these letters, and they start comparing evidence and things like that. And a rock with, what is it, runes on it?
Right. Yeah. We'll discuss what happens to that.
Yeah.
Because that something happens to that, but other evidence such as a phonograph and pictures and things, pictures of both, of like, the rock, but also pictures of footprints in mud and things like that are sent, and then a phonograph is sent, and then eventually a rock with runes is on its way, we'll discuss what happens to that and various letters where it get lost or quote unquote lost in the mail. You're gonna say something, Barrett?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you have to consider when he wrote this, it's interesting to hear the technology that he's talking about that to him was probably amazing, not so much to us, but it's interesting the things that they're able to do back in the 20s when he's writing this story. Talking about Einstein at certain points in the story as well.
And Einstein's a contemporary too.
Yeah, he's a contemporary. It's quite interesting.
It's crazy because, you know, it's a point in history where a lot of these great minds and new inventions are basically changing the world. For us, we're just their past achievements and, like, you know, things that, you know, kind of take for granted, some, you know. But then it was just like these were the people and the inventions that would bring the world to new heights. You know, modern living and everything like that.
They're still getting used to the idea of the telephone.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's the thing, right? Einstein, Freud, Edison, Westinghouse, the Wright brothers. You know, all these people are popping up. And then writers like Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, and as I mentioned, Arthur Machen, you know, and all these things are just there. And it's just a phenomenal time to live, because everything is changing so quickly and so dramatically in such a short time.
Yeah. I think that actually kind of ties into how, in some way with, you know, the story's themes about bringing things to even greater heights. This is written during a point where, as I said before, the world is changing. Modern life is becoming, you know, something drastically different. You know, the phone and other inventions, great minds who are going to make incredible breakthroughs and make stories that would just live on and stuff like that. And now we have this character who's meeting beings that are going to do something in a way that are going to bring things into greater heights that are hard, in a sense, to comprehend. You know, they never thought, you never thought that, that it was possible. And it's kind of interesting that, you know, as Kevin had mentioned, people were just amazed by the phones that the possibility of talking to people like that was even a, could be a thing.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I didn't even mention Henry Fullwood and various other folks. But yeah. The first thing that Henry Akeley does mention to Albert Wilmoth, besides having evidence, and I liked how you guys said evidence rather than proof, right? Because because that's it's evidence, it's not proof.
I said proof, and then I changed that to evidence.
Yeah, and that was a good term to say evidence. And the main thing besides all that evidence, which obviously is somewhat appealing to Wilmoth, is also Akeley isn't just talking about bodies floating in the water that were unidentifiable during the Vermont floods of 1927, but he's also talking about contact with something in the woods. So it's not just people disappearing or unidentified quote unquote beings or objects, if you prefer. He's actually discussing things such as actual third encounters with creatures or something in the forest. And that's right, exactly. The X-Files. This is true X-Files. Let me give you this minor definition of amigo. Amigo, I think that's how you pronounce it, is basically the supposedly the creatures, and the name I think is maybe used once, Migu or Migu, in the story. But they're, this is right from Wikipedia. Migu are large, pinkish, fungoid, crustacean-like entities the size of a man. Where a head would be, they have a convoluted ellipsoid composed of pyramided, fleshy rings and covered in antenna. They're about 5 feet long, and their crustacean-like bodies bear numerous sets of paired appendages. They possess a pair of membranous bat-like wings, which are used to fly through the aether of outer space. The wings do not work or function on Earth, and that's pretty much it. They leave footprints like crabs in the mud or snow, and they talk in a buzzing sound, but they can supposedly speak human languages if they so desire. They also, based off of what Akeley says, these folklore beings, or what he calls extraterrestrials, the Migu, are living in the forests, in the mountains above his house. He lives on the side of Dark Mountain somewhere near the base, and then his backyard goes up the mountain, basically all the way to the top. And in the forest on the mountain, there's caves and various other places that supposedly these Migu live and are doing mining and things of that nature for elements that they can take back to their home, where Pluto, the planet Pluto at the time of the planet Pluto, was their base in our solar system, but they're from another solar system. Also, he says they have made alliances with some local humans, both those that are considered mountain folk, like hick or rednecks or whatever, as well as educated folk as well, who basically do their bidding when they can't go to town and things of that nature. So Akeley isn't quite sure why these folk, and he names a couple of them, Brown, some farmer named Brown, and a few others, that he doesn't know if they're getting money or some reward, or if they're just traitors to the human race. But either way, he thinks they're a danger, even though folklore in the past has stated that if you don't go into the forest and don't bother them, they will not bother you. So similar to why I think he brings up the Arthur Makem stories, like fairies and whatnot, where if you don't bother them, they generally won't bother you. And he said, anybody want to add to that? Because again, a lot of that we learned as the letters exchange between the two principal characters happens. But again, this is the generally, some of it is told in the folklore section at the beginning of the story, but we learn throughout the story anyway. Anybody want to add to any of that?
Yeah, it is the classic setup of the conspiracy or the secret village or the hidden community of dealings where dealings are taking place that, you know, the outsider is not supposed to know about. Because throughout this, as you mentioned, Akeley is trying to spy and gather information and try and prove the existence of this, of these creatures and their relationship with some of the locals and stuff like that. And there's someone who's trying to silence them. Way back in this recording, we mentioned has some of his attempts to bring in proof are being halted. Actually, he regrets several times where he's being spied on. His watchdog, his guard dogs are being killed one after the other, whether it's being from human means or something else. It becomes this little thing where he's completely paranoid that he is going to be silenced or just outright disappear because someone or something doesn't want him telling anybody about what he's seen.
Now, also, Abe, as he's beginning to do this, I guess, quote unquote, research to, I guess, prove their existence or at least figure out what is going on, he suddenly, meaning Henry Akeley, suddenly feels that he has become a target of the creatures because just like he thought earlier, if you don't bother them, they usually don't bother you. But as you get into their business or their territory, they become threatened and then, quote unquote, may want to eliminate you. And Akeley begins to believe at a certain point in the story during this letter communication, he has now become a target because of his nosiness, if you prefer, we could say his investigation. Anyone want to comment on it?
Well, I'm not sure that he would have been free of their interference even if he hadn't investigated them. I think that he was so close to them that he would have been bothered regardless.
He would consider it a risk, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because they had people around him that were watching him, and they knew immediately when he did start to investigate them. So I think that he would have eventually been a target. That's just my feeling. But.
Well, and I think you're right, Barrett, and I'll tell you why I think you're right, because as we learn through these letters and Akeley discussing his history, his family, the Akeley ancestors have been in this area for a long time, of Vermont, so they're a very old family in southeast Vermont, as well as the homestead, the Akeley homestead or farm. It has been in his family's generation to generation to generation. So it's been there for a while. So if only recently, meaning the past few years, these creatures have begun to be, I guess, more vocal or noticeable by him, they're slowly moving into his land or his territory. Mm-hmm. So I think you may be right that he was in trouble just because they have decided to expand their radius, and his property now just happens to be in that radius. And as a result, if these creatures are indeed real or a threat, if they are real, then he would be in trouble. All right, so let's talk about our professor for a second. And what's your guys' thoughts at this point about Wilmoth, Albert Wilmoth, and his buying into Akeley and, I guess, his quote-unquote crazy stories?
I think Wilmoth is, you know, has acted like how many of us would be in the beginning. You know, his pen pal, his Mr. Akeley is, you know, the claims are very extraordinary. And yeah, as it goes along, they become very alarming, because even while he may doubt how true these might be, he also still can. He already quickly starts feeling concerned for Akeley, because he thinks maybe the guy's going insane, or maybe there is some kind of danger, but it's not this fantastical alien-like presence that he is describing. But then he gets to even a point where he has to believe to some extent, as he finally starts hearing the sound recordings. And here's more about how well described in detail these beings and their and this world is, that it sounds almost so well thought out, too well thought out to be some kind of lie or delusion. And that kind of has pulled them into this, you know, this circle of, you know, now being one of those people that these creatures and those who connect to him are concerned about, because now he has great knowledge of their presence, whether he completely believes it or not. That, but he at least knows a lot of, since Akeley told him. So he felt how he deals with it as the story goes on is very believable, and he still holds a bit of skepticism and also some good common sense in how he approaches it as best he can. I thought it was a really nice point where he Agent Scully is in his mind right now is kind of being broken down to the point where he has to accept what he's hearing, what he's reading.
Now, so the record is basically from a few years earlier, prior to this whole event, where, because I was checking, I think that it said it was like 1915 or something like that was when the record was recorded by Akeley, and this is taking place in like 1927, so 12 years later, when the Vermont floods occurred. And Akeley, suddenly became aware of what was going on in the forest through the folklore, and then suddenly seen things or heard things himself that disturbed him. And so he went to this cave that he knew was not too far from his property line. And he brought a phonograph that could record, and he recorded what he heard. And what he heard was voices, one human voice, very Bostonian educated, like a Harvard accent, like John Kennedy, for example, and then numerous buzzing sounds or voices that sounded buzzing, and he claims those were the Megu, and then there was a human person that was the Harvard accent person, and they were basically doing incantations and kind of religious ceremonies to greater beings and names that we've heard in many Lovecraft stories, such as Nyarlathotep and Hester and various other creatures, Yog-Sothoth and whatever. And yeah, that's it. Thank you. And so forth. So when What's-His-Face gets to wreck it and he hears it, obviously he's somewhat disturbed himself, the professor, and he actually believes it anyway. And so what happens next is, after seeing the photographs and the record, Akeley says that he's going to send him the rune. It's because around every so often in the middle of the forest, you'll come to a stone that's buried in the ground with runes and stuff in it. And so he unburied one of them and brought it back to his house. And since the photographs are primitive and you can't see the runes that well, and I assume Akeley, it mustn't be a good drawer, he decides that he's going to mail the rune stone to Akeley in Massachusetts. And at this point, they've already lost letters in the mail, and Akeley's already concerned that some of the letters may have been intercepted by the human allies of the Magoo.
Yeah, he's even going further out to have his letters sent.
Right.
Further away from the area.
Exactly. So instead of going to Brattleboro, which is the quote-unquote bigger town in the area, and right on the Connecticut River near New Hampshire, he decides to go a little north to Bellow Falls and try to send it out that way. And basically they're going to take a train, which would take the stone through Keene, New Hampshire, to Winchendon, Massachusetts, and then all the way to downtown Boston. And then from Boston, the mail would deliver it from Boston to Cape Ann, where Arkham, the false town, that's the one town in the story that doesn't exist in real life, is located. And unfortunately, it too gets lost. And when they do research to find out what happened, again, there's this mysterious man that is never identified, but is probably the reason the stone never made it to the professor, because it was intercepted most likely in Keene, New Hampshire, which is directly west of me. So let's talk about what happens. Basically, Akeley begins to buy dogs, and so we're talking 15, 20
dogs.
Yeah, and he doesn't say what type, but you assume they're, you know, German Shepherds, Doberman Pinschers, Labrador Retrievers, Basset, whatever those big giant dogs are, St. Bernards, you know, Newfoundlands, whatever. So big dogs to basically
selling guy dogs very much after like the first go.
Yeah, well, and he goes through those dogs pretty fast.
Oh God, he does. It's to the point where I keep thinking, why is the breeder, where he's getting them from, is raising an eyebrow, like, what the fuck?
What are you doing?
they actually reference it.
If it was today, you would imagine the Humane Society would be coming after and going, why on earth are you, you know, in or the HPSA or whatever.
Well, there's two things. One, he is a farmer. He lives out in the middle of nowhere, so you figure he has the land for it. But second, Lovecraft, or I should say, the character of the professor does mention it once, where he says, I think he says it in the story, he goes, when he went to Bellows Falls to buy more dogs, he was curious what the breeder would think, because he keeps on asking for more dogs. So at least he does reference it, so I'll give him that. And so what happens is, every night after dark, when there's no moon, when there's no moon to light the yard, these Maigu and their human allies basically do a siege on the Akeley farmstead. And Akeley and his dogs are the only things protecting the house from these creatures. And every night that they attack, one or two dogs gets killed off, basically.
And at one point, they hurt the things attacking, and he finds, like, green goo on top of his house and outside.
Right. And then eventually he actually shoots one of the beasts, meaning the Magoo, and he drags it into his shed, his farm building, and he takes some pictures of it, but the thing melts away, and also even the photograph doesn't take the photo of the creature.
You got to call Mego, because every time you say Magoo,
So the thing is that I liked how Lovecraft had our main character, Albert Wilmoth, say that he must have mishandled the camera, because anything that is solid has to be, you know, you have to be able to take a picture of it, right? I mean, again, because they're not ghosts, but again, this is supernatural, so we don't really know, and it's never explained.
I don't know if it's supposed to be supernatural or not. I think maybe it's because it's atoms are operating on a different frequency, so the photographs can't be taken.
Which is kind of interesting, because the author, Walter Schreiber, I forget his name, who writes about the Greys all the time, the aliens that are the, you know, the bald gray aliens, talks about how they can be invisible because they shift their atoms quickly, and so they're never at the same spot when you're looking at them. So even though they're in front of you and you could walk into them, you can't see them because they're not actually in the exact same spot, because the atoms are shifting. Even if it's only a millimeter or an eighth of an inch, it's enough to make them disappear, because they're moving continuously at a super speed. So it could be something like that. You have a good point there by bringing that up, that the atoms, something to do with the atoms, may be the reason why it's not photographable. Akeley is concerned that he's going to be killed off within the fortnight. But what's his face? The professor says, just get the hell out of there and, you know, move down to a hotel or an inn or something in Bellows Fall or Brattleboro, and get out of your home in Townsend. And during these letters of like fear and disgust and all that, what happens is that our lead character, the professor, gets a bunch of letters from the Akeley, the farmer, but out of order, and also interrupted, meaning his letters don't reach Akeley, but he gets five of Akeley's at one time, for example. And let's talk about how Akeley suddenly changes, and from saying don't get involved, maybe we should stop talking, let's forget this, to everything is fine and dandy.
Yeah,
you should come visit me and bring all the evidence.
Exactly.
Right.
I just thought that.
My suspicious mind is saying no.
You have a really high IQ, but you're still an idiot. Because you get a lot of his letters returned. He says, "Oh yeah, don't worry. I think what happened was they even said, oh yeah, we found the rock. You know, we found the rock with the runes on it." And then the Akeley was even saying, you know, because for a while he wanted to leave, and I think his son lived in California, and he pretty much said, look, I don't want to leave my home, you know, this has been like my home for generations, but you know, it's time for me to get out of here. And he's just about ready to just pack it up. And he says, you know, if you don't hear from me, you know, if you don't hear from me, get a hold of my, I'll be dead, you know, get a hold of my son, tell him what's going on. And then all of a sudden, oh yeah, everything's fine. It was just a misunderstanding. Don't worry, we're friends now. Yeah, why don't you come on over and bring all the evidence?
What could go wrong?
Yeah, what could go wrong? And I'll give you all of this knowledge that you could never, you can't possibly imagine.
It's pretty much, Pennywise in the drain with the balloon. Hey, we're buddies. Come here. Let me show you the carnival.
Yeah, exactly.
You'll float too.
Oh hell. Yeah, I mean that was that. I mean, as I'm going through this, I'm thinking to myself, is this professor that dim? I mean, I know he's a professor, I know he's smart, but as far as wisdom goes, he's lacking.
Right. Well, and that's the thing is, like, okay, let's say he was going to go to this remote, or at least at the time, a remote town of Townsend, Vermont, to an area of the country that he's never been to. Again, if you lived where Abe lives, Abe is generally a suburbanite of Boston, probably similar to where Arkham is to Boston. Abe would be about 25 miles away from Boston. To drive from where Abe is to Townsend, Vermont, is no big deal today. You know, you just take Route 2 all the way, or Route 90 all the way, and then take 91 up to Townsend, and you're there in an hour and 20 minutes,
That brings up one area where he's smart. He drives instead of taking the train, if you recall.
Right. Well, and that's the thing is that, and for me to get to Townsend is basically, you know, 50 minutes. And the thing is that, he can't get coworkers or friends. I mean, it appears he has no family, so he can't bring family, and he's not going to be able to ask people that he works with to go, because they think he's crazy too. So he can't really tell anybody. So if he does go, he has to go alone. If he could bring a bunch of people with him, like, you know, his secretaries and his the people that do his research and all that, he could bring, you know, students or whatever, but he doesn't want to, obviously, because if he does, they're all going to think he's a nut. So if he does go, he's got to go alone. And for whatever reason, he has the guts to go alone. And as you said, Barrett, he's going to take his car and head over there. Well, actually, no. You know what? He takes his car to Boston, but then he takes the train, I think, because you remember he gets off the train in Brattleboro, and he gets in the car with the someone that meets him there.
Yeah, what happens is that he wants to come in earlier or something like that, and they he wants to come in, or like they said, oh yeah, why don't you take the later train? He says, I'd rather take the earlier one, you know, and I'll just leave, you know, I'll just drive to such and such. And so what happens is, like, he drives to another, instead of like in Boston, he drives to another town, takes a train.
I think he drives to like Fitchburg, Massachusetts, which isn't too far from me and Abe. And then he takes the train from there that goes to Keene and then to Brattleboro in the earlier train, as you mentioned, Kevin. He gets off the train expecting to meet Akeley, and instead he meets this other guy there instead, who says he's there for Akeley. And this guy's name is, I think, Noyes.
Yeah. He sounds familiar.
Yeah, he does. Exactly. Based off of where the story goes, we're assuming that it was probably the Bostonian voice on the record. Right. It's never mentioned, but we can assume that that's the case. But our professor is clueless. He just thinks the voice sounds familiar. And instead, he gets in the car with Noyes, and Noyes says, well, you know, I'll bring you to Townsend, which is like 3 to 5 towns away from Brattleboro. And they have to drive because obviously it's rural roads and whatnot. So let's talk about.
And then perhaps, they asked a few times. Yeah. Oh yeah, did you bring the film? Did you bring?
Yeah.
Did you bring the letters that the guy that Akeley wrote you? You know, I mean, they keep on asking. Oh, did you bring it? Did you bring it?
Right, right. And the reason Akeley supposedly says to bring all this stuff is they can go through all the letters and all the photographs and all that and put all their notes together and you know, blah, 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 and all that crap. And Will Moth believes it all. But we didn't explain what Akeley said. Akeley's last letter from the change of, like, I'm going to die to his very last letter before setting up the trip for Will Moth to join him in Townsend is he says that he became friendly with the creatures. He found out they're not dangerous. They're just here to get, as I said earlier, you know, mining things and rocks and stuff that they need for their whatever. There's no danger. And if anything, it's good to be friends with them because we can learn all their technologies and whatnot. And so Will Moth really likes this letter. Because he's shocked since it's a 180, but he also likes the letter because he, being who he is very curious to learn all these technologies and folklore of these creatures and whatever too. So I think that's the reason why he falls for going. So let's talk about the Akeley farm and what we find at Akeley's farm and what goes on there. Because now this is really the last third of the book, basically, right?
Yep.
All right. So who wants to go? Abe, you're pretty good at this stuff. What do we got? What do we got?
When he gets there, things at first don't seem out of the ordinary. You know, and it kind of, you know, it feels contradictory to what he's been hearing in these letters the entire time. You know, he you know, considering this, from all these letters he's been hearing about this attempted siege and several fights and, you know, gunfire and all stuff like that, but nothing seems, you know, off at first.
Let's talk about Akeley himself. Now that we get Will Moth actually gets to come face to face with his, I guess, what as we called him, pen pal.
Well, we hear that he's sick on the drive there.
Yes. And when he gets there, he Akeley is very. He's sitting in his chair a lot. He's very. Almost very lucid. He's exhausted, and he can barely hold a conversation very much for very long. And requires a great deal of rest a lot of the time. And yet he echoes a lot of what what the professor had heard in the other letters. And we get to share with him all the stuff he's learned from these creatures.
Yep. Anybody would comment? Anyone?
Yeah, I mean, and at some point he sends him to have dinner, I guess. And the coffee tastes weird, so he doesn't drink it. It has some kind of acrid taste to it. Later on, right. He thinks that maybe they tried to drug him.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like sandwiches and coffee. He turns down to coffee because he felt it smelled funny. But being the clueless guy he is and thinking nothing's out of place, even though Akeley is ill, sitting in a lazy boy in the corner, wrapped with bandages because he claims he has some sort of cold and arthritis type problems.
Sure, buddy.
And, yeah, right. And it's no lights on, and the shades are pulled, so you can't really see him that well anyway. But he, the way Wilmoth acts, it's the coffee's just bad. You know, like when you go to someone's house and they offer you coffee and then you taste a sip and you go, oh, they make a terrible coffee. I mean, we've seen it in plenty of movies where people will take a sip of coffee and they either say, this is the best coffee I've ever had, or spit it out because it's terrible. And basically that's what Wilmoth's acting like here, where it's like, oh, it's just bad coffee, not anything suspicious. So what else do we have to talk about before the final setup? Do we learn the machine? Yeah, we learn about the machines, right?
He tells them the history of these creatures, basically, doesn't he? Kind of like,
yeah,
everything about them. Well, not everything, but a long history of them.
Yeah.
Where they come from and why they're there, how benevolent they are.
Yeah, how about who wants to explain how they transport humans to visit their farm?
It's like there was a lot of detail in this. I mean, Lovecraft really loves to go into it, but from what I remember, the brain is locked into some kind of fluid, and through some sort of weird ass process, is able to project his conscience to beyond these outer reaches, far beyond any spaceship or anything like that, to this world. So thus they can see and experience everything through that, this kind of like strange perception, without any sort of pain or anything like that, and learn and communicate with these creatures.
Well, don't they put them in a metal container, and can't the beings carry them in those metal containers to their planet?
Yeah, basically what it is, it's they somehow take your brain out of your head. They put them in these containers that are metal containers that also can be the metal can be removed and they become glass. So it's like glass casing.
Yeah,
glass casing, and then the metal goes on top of the glass like a cylinder, and then you can connect this voice box type of mechanical speaker to the brain, the canister, and the canister can read the thoughts of the brain, and the brain then can communicate with audio and hear as well. And they also, and the brain also can see as well, because these little machines that they connect to the canister can allow the brain to speak, hear, and see. And then what happens is the canisters are then, as Barrett mentioned, can be brought to the foreign world because the body isn't able to.
Yeah, and Akeley tells him that he's planning on doing it, having his brain removed and put into a cylinder.
It's kind of like he's transmitting his soul to across space and time. Then I think doesn't he even say, "Oh yeah, just ignore the can with my name on it."
Yes. Yeah.
I'm like, oh come on! And the thing is, you barely see his, you don't see his face very well. You don't. I mean, he's all covered up. How dim do you have to be for crying out loud?
I know. Akeley even has him speak to one of these brains.
Yeah.
Who describes the whole everything?
Tells them all about the positive things. This is great.
Well, I don't even. Let's face it. I don't think that's Akeley anymore.
Oh no! 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 No!
I don't think so either. I think that's the whole point, is that something else is talking to him.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's not Akeley, but it's something.
Yeah. It's the Mare Goo sales pitch man who's really trying to convince the professor to pretty much come into the circle. Make them make him one of them, in a sense, and as a way to not only gain extra follower, but to eliminate the evidence that they so easily convince the professor to bring.
Right. So there's a couple of things. I mean, us being the reader are pretty much able to figure this out more so than our protagonist. But basically what's happening is Akeley has been kidnapped by the aliens. The body,
kidnapped.
Brainnapped. Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. So the body what appears to be Akeley in the corner, covered with bandages and whatnot because of his arthritis and illness and whatever, is really nothing because it doesn't move much, and the voice that's behind it is most likely one of the Maigo. And then Akeley letter was probably written by Noyce, and what happens is that they try to get this guy here, Wilmoth, the professor, here to Vermont to take all the evidence from him and convince him to join, quote-unquote, Akeley to visit Pluto and outer solar system, outer space.
What, wasn't the last letter typed?
Yes, it was different than the others.
Yeah, the last letter was typed with the typewriter.
Yeah. He explains it, too, why he did it that way. Like his hands were aching or something.
Right. He's already setting up the arthritis problem.
Yeah, the arthritis and thickness.
But,
yeah.
I mean, he didn't even sign it. I mean, oh, my goodness. This professor is an idiot. I'm sorry.
But also, if the professor doesn't agree to go, and again, he's going to be there for a few days so they can try to work on him, they are planning to drug him with the coffee, and then they will just rip out his brain after they incapacitate him. So it's all a setup to really take the evidence and remove both Akeley and Wilmoth from the chessboard, in a sense. But again, Wilmoth doesn't know this yet. So Akeley says that he's just going to sleep in his chair because it's too hard for him to move because of his arthritis. However, upstairs, you know, there's a room for you and whatnot, and there's a bathroom up there and whatever. And this is when Wilmoth begins to become suspicious, right? Because he hears the arguing between noise, a buzzing sound, which is obviously one of the Mago, and a third voice, which he's assuming is Akeley, but it sounds mechanical. And again, that's because we already are being convinced that Akeley's brain has already been ripped out of his body and is in one of that canister that was already labeled Akeley earlier.
It's an interesting way that he writes this too, because he writes, you know, he writes about what he's hearing and everything, and then it goes to him having escaped, and then he goes back to telling you what happened, which I found interesting in how he did that.
Yeah, exactly. What makes him decide to escape again? I forget what. Oh, yeah, that's right. He goes downstairs, and what happens, he doesn't tell us, like you just said, Barrett.
Yeah.
But bails, and he bails because what does he do? He steals a car, right?
Steals the car that's in the garage.
Yeah, well, the one that Noyce has.
He also gets suspicious because it doesn't, like, while he's in his room, doesn't somebody try to open up the door, locked it? Yeah. He tries. He locks the door just because he's starting to get suspicious. He locks the door, and he hears somebody turning the knob, and it's like, okay, this isn't right. This is, and because he can hear the footsteps and all that. So,
dun dun dun.
Yeah.
right. So. He something happens where he goes downstairs, and something happens that spooks him, and so he decides to bail, and he steals the car that's what we think, I think, is Noyce's car that's in the barn or the garage. What's that?
I think it's Akeley's.
Yeah, it's Akeley's car.
It is Akeley's. Okay,
yeah, it's like a Ford, I think he says.
All right. Yeah, and then he escapes, but he loses all his possessions that he brought with him, included all the proof, all the letters, all the pictures, the phonograph, and everything. Who wants to talk about what happens before he leaves to spook him out when he decides to sneak downstairs and whatnot?
Well, I mean, he comes downstairs, and he's kind of looking around to see if anybody's around or anything like that. And he's checking out the different rooms, and he sees what he thinks is Akeley. But when he looks, all he sees really is his face and glove and, like, hands. And that's it. And, you know, no body, just face. I think it's just face and hands and no body at all. And he just flips out, screams, and runs, and just, you know, that's when he realizes this is, you know, that's when he knows that something very bad happened.
Oh yeah, someone was weakening Bernie and Akeley from behind the scenes.
Yes. So I mean, granted, I mean, I'd be pretty freaked out too if I go down and I see who I think is just some guy sleeping. You're trying to nudge him awake, and turns out it's just a face. Like, and that's face and blanket, and that's it. You know, nothing else.
Something had to be animating it because it was moving when he was down there originally.
Well, I mean, it could have been, you know, it could have been one of the neighbors who was. I mean, my guess is it had to have been one of the neighbors who was in on it, because
I'm thinking it's an alien of some sort.
Well,
because,
at first I thought that, but the thing is that when the aliens talk, they have a buzzing noise.
Those aliens, there might be others.
Oh, but you got to remember Akeley's voice. He was whispering when he spoke, because he said his part of the illness, it made his voice lose his voice.
That's true.
So
it would have been the brain cylinder voice.
So he's the whisperer in the darkness.
Yeah, the whisperer in the darkness. That's the way the title comes from. And the whisperer, my guess is what you said, Barrett. It was the alien, and it was like behind the lazy boy or something, and that was what was moving the hands every so often and was speaking, and it was speaking in a whispering voice, because obviously if it spoke in a normal tone voice, you would hear the buzzing, and then you would know it wouldn't be human. That was my assumption.
True.
That's kind of where I was going. Yeah. Well, and it says it had an odd buzzing whispering sound, not just a whispering sound too. So you're probably exactly correct, is that it was one of the aliens.
Yeah, I forgot about the buzz. I don't remember about the buzzing bit.
Yeah, and then he also looks in Akeley's. Doesn't he look in Akeley's brain cylinder too? He wants to connect to it. He says he almost was going to connect speakers to it to speak to Akeley to see, you know, because you know that if Akeley's in there, Akeley's going to say, "Get out of here! They already kidnapped me. I'm doomed," or something like that.
Right.
But he decides to just bail, because he doesn't think he has enough time to do anything.
Oh, I thought he just saw the face and the gloves or whatever and just screamed and ran out. I mean, I think he may have thought about wanting to go back in, but as he was running for his life to the car, but he thought, no, I'm just going to run for my life to the car. Akeley's dead. There's nothing I can do.
Which is honestly one of the smarter things he does.
Yeah. One of the wisest things he's done in the whole story.
Right. Now, obviously, we all probably already knew that Akeley was already killed or brain-napped, as Kevin said, at the point where we get the letter that says, "Everything is fine now. Come and visit and bring all the evidence with you."
Once there was that big change, we knew he was done for.
So we knew Akeley was gone as the reader and whatnot. But the surprise at the end, the big surprise, when you figure that, oh my God, the whole time Akeley, his brain, he wasn't just killed, but they had basically turned him into a slave and all that. What did you guys think of that ending? Because when I read it first 8 years ago, whenever it was, I was blown away how awesome it was, and it scared the hell out of me. Because I wasn't expecting it, even though I already knew that Akeley was probably doomed. What was your feelings of this ending? Since we're at the ending now.
I thought it was awesome.
Yeah, I thought it was really good.
Yeah.
I think this. I think one thing that Lovecraft really does well is just portray in his writing fates that are far worse than death. Things that, you know, we prefer not to happen to us, and just the very concept of it is just almost madness-inducing. That it could, you know, what's the phrase? I have no mouth. By my screen. It's from a story or something like that.
There you go. Right, right.
Well, and I have to say, one of the things that I really like about this story is how he incorporates the discovery of Pluto into his story and makes it so sinister. Because the discovery of Pluto actually happened, you know, that year in February, and he wrote the story in September, or published it in September. So I just find that really awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right. So what else do we want to talk about? Oh, go on.
Well, it's like when I mentioned at the beginning about that one adaptation to film, now that we're ended at the end of this. It's funny because the way they ended it in the movie that I saw, the professor leaves, but what happens is instead of stealing the car, he steals an airplane, and the creatures figure out how to fly. They're flying and they're chasing them, and something happens. The plane goes down, and the next thing you know is you see the professor's face kind of in that machine that, you know, hooks up the brain, but it's now his brain that's in the jar hooked up to the machine, and he's kind of all this, yes, this is the greatest thing to ever happen to me, and he sounds like he's like some part of a cult.
You saw the exact same one I saw, and they added a third act onto it because they felt like the book, as far as being turned into a movie, didn't have the right third act. It didn't have a third act, so they added in all this extra stuff at the end. Yeah, it was in black and white, and I remember the whole plane part.
Yeah,
it was a good movie, though. It just, you know,
they created
that end themselves.
Yeah, and I wish they didn't do that. I thought the original ending was far better.
An interesting note about that movie is that Sandy Peterson, who helped write the Cthulhu RPG rules, was a producer of that movie.
Oh, I mean, the thing is that at the end of the movie, I can see Lovecraft ending it that way.
Yeah,
that is a Lovecraftian ending, you know, but in this case, you know, they just changed it. So the reason why I didn't like it is just because they changed it so much.
Sure, sure. Well, and in this book, or this novella, if you prefer, was so shocking, I felt, that it's going to be tough to beat it, you know, by, I guess, changing it in you know, movie format. I mean, it'll be curious to see. As you said, Kevin, there was another adaptation that you saw as a movie out there, low budget. And I'd be curious to see that, to see if they were able to pull it off. I mean, I don't think it could have been pulled off that well, because if it was, we would have been already hearing about this movie, you know, a long time ago, right? I mean, it would be considered a cult classic rather than just a movie, right?
Well, no, it was very low budget. I mean, you can tell that.
Yeah.
This was a labor of love. A bunch of guys decided, hey, let's do an adaptation just for the fun of it. And I admire him for doing that. I really admire him for doing that. I mean, it was obviously low budget, but I still thought for a very low budget, you know, not even maxing out your credit card thing, I thought they did a fantastic job. I
totally agree.
I mean, it's kind of, it's for me, I have to admit, it's almost inspiring to like want to get a group of friends of yours, you know, friends together and try doing that yourself. You know,
sound like fun.
I mean, just put it on YouTube, and if it gets hit, or even somehow sell it to Netflix, you know, and if it gets hits, great. If it doesn't, who cares? If it gets one star, I don't know. I don't care. It's just one of those. It just sounds like it would have been fun just doing it.
Well, I like how they did it in black and white too. It was
absolutely.
Yeah.
No, black and white was a great choice. Somebody did Thing on the Doorstep in black and white, but they made it modern too, which was
interesting.
It was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that seems weird, but I'd have to see it.
Yeah, I think I saw it on YouTube.
Interesting. Yeah, a lot of that stuff makes it to YouTube. All right, so I guess we can. Anything else that anybody wanted to mention about the story itself that we were planning to mention that hasn't been brought up yet? Anything? Anybody? All right, no problems. We'll give our final thoughts in a little while. But before we do, anything anybody wants to bring up to our listeners about genre related? I know you, Barrett, you've been watching Ozark. What do you think?
I'm enjoying it. You know, I don't have as much time to spend as I would like to watch it, so I'm not getting through it as fast as I would like. But yeah, it's a good show. Jason Bateman does a great job. I've always liked him. And Laura Linney, of course, is always awesome. But all the acting is really top notch. It's just a great show. I'm curious to see where it goes.
Very good. Very good.
Can't wait until I catch up.
And where are you right now?
I am halfway through the first season.
Right. Have you met the Darlene and her husband yet?
Yes. Oh yeah.
Okay. Yeah. What's their last name? It begins with an S.
Yeah, I can't think of it.
Yeah, I can't. The Snoots or something like that. Yeah. Very good.
Let me mention another Netflix show, too. I just recently finished with my wife. The October Faction was pretty interesting.
Okay.
It's based, on a comic book, but it's kind of supernaturally, kind of science fiction-y. It's basically about monster hunters and warlocks and monsters and...
What's the show called?
It's called The October Faction.
Is that?
And what's Orlocks?
Warlocks. Yeah, oh, Warlocks.
And is it modern day? Takes place in modern day, or?
Yeah, it takes place in modern day, and it's in like a small town.
Is that about that family that's doing that kind of investigations and stuff like that?
It's the parents are doing monster hunting, and that's all I want to say because I would give too much away if I say too much. Okay. But it's quite an interesting show. Had a good twist ending I didn't see coming for the first season. I don't know if there's going to be another season, but it's worth watching the 10 episodes that they've got out there.
And kind of sad news. I mean, this is kind of related to horror is... Fred Willard, who starred in Salem's Lot, passed. It was either
yesterday. He did.
Yeah.
And that was sad. I mean, that was sad because, I mean, obviously we've seen him in so many things, but I mean, the first time I ever remember.
He played the realtor in Salem's Lot.
Yeah. He, crumbs. I just blanked on his name, but, he passed.
The actor. His name? Didn't you already say his name? Willard or something like that?
No, his character's name.
Oh, right. Yeah, I forget it too. It was actually the character was named after the realtor, but the TV show mixed it with a couple of characters, I think.
I think it was so too.
Well, at least two.
But I mean, primarily, he was Tibbet? No, not Tibbet. I don't remember. But yeah, he was primarily the realtor. And that, yeah.
Yeah, because it was mixed of two characters at least, yeah. I'm trying to find the cast here. Here we go.
Crockett.
What's that?
Is Nick Crockett?
Crockett, yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
exactly. All right, very good. What about you, Abe? You got any genre stuff that you want to bring up, or anime or anything like that, video games?
Nothing new right now, currently. I just been kind of busy now getting back into work and stuff like that. We finally just started going back to jobs and stuff like recently, so I've been trying to adjust my schedule to have some free time to check out some other stuff.
All right, very well. Yeah, for me, let's see. Me and Barrett actually recorded a new episode of the Halloween Boutique Psychotronic Reviews podcast that I was doing for a while that had gone on hiatus. And so me and Barrett did an episode of that. And we talked about what we felt was a pretty good independent horror film from a couple of years ago, right, Barrett?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah. So, folks can look for that. The film that we talked about. I guess we'll wait. People will just see the episode when it comes out, and they can listen to it. So that's all I got. What about you, Barrett? You had any further things you wanted to bring up?
Nothing else.
What about you, Kevin?
Nope.
All right. So I guess we can get into our final thoughts on the story. So Abe. Actually, since you weren't here in our intro because of some conflicts you had, why don't you give how you heard about the story, first time you read it, and your final thoughts or your thoughts in general of the tale itself?
Well, when we started doing these book episodes, after we covered a couple of King's stories, we actually tried to dive into a number of Lovecraft short stories, but we realized some of them were much longer than others, and it was hard to get through them all in just in time. And Whisper in the Dark is our second of these stories. And I think I've heard of the title before. This was my first time. I actually listened to it on YouTube for an audiobook. And there's a guy on YouTube. You find his channel easily if you just put in Lovecraft audio readings and stuff like that, who does a really good job of, you know, just reading these stories. And so I kind of hit back and listened to it, and I liked it. And I really love how Lovecraft really just he finds these moments in history to kind of be nice kickoff points, whether it's things happen around him, you know, or just historical, something it acts as a nice catalyst for his stories. As it was talked about here, with Pluto's discovery and stuff like that, you know, these themes of, you know, taking our knowledge and discoveries to greater heights if possible, and I guess even bringing into question the cost of seeking that knowledge, a recurring theme in his other stories as well. I enjoy this one. I think, you know, I like both this one and Thing on the Doorstep pretty equally. I think each one does something really interesting. I'm just glad we finally got to talk about it. This episode was almost cursed for us. We had to do a lot of delays and pushbacks. So I'm very happy we got the chance to talk about it, and this was a fun episode.
All right, very good. Abe, what about you, Barrett?
I really enjoy this story. I've read it a few times. I think it showcases his ability of taking normal happenings that are actually happening and make them seem sinister, and taking just what, you know, simple things, and they slowly become more and more terrifying until in the end you're like, oh wow, it went there. And this story really showcases that nicely, especially with the brains in the canister at the very end. Yeah. I think it's one of his better stories. It's tight. It's not too long. It's not too short. It's just a really good story. If you want to get a good taste of Lovecraft, I think this one would do nicely to get you introduced to his writing style. So I highly suggest the story.
Very good. Yeah, for me, yeah, this is actually one of my favorite stories out of his most famous story. So I read like about 40 of them, and this is one of the ones that really stuck out to me. I felt it was very uncomfortable. I was really into Akeley trying to make it out alive, and I actually liked Akeley's character more than the professor, and then the shock at the end and whatnot just kind of blew me away. As Barrett said, and Abe mentioned too, this is a perfect story for the writing style of Lovecraft. A lot of time he writes where the character is narrating the whole time, and it's not a true first person, and yet it's definitely not third person. It's just an interesting way, and this is a typical and great introduction to Lovecraft, and is actually one of my favorite types of writing and reading for stories. So for me, it really works. But all in all, it's a top-notch classic horror tale. And with the science fiction elements added, it makes it even more impressive and, I guess, quote unquote, freaky. Let's go to you, Kevin.
I can't really add on to what anybody else said, except it's a very good story. There's not a slow point in any of this. Lovecraft did a very good job putting it together, and there is no real part that you can trim out. There's no extraneous stuff that you can trim out. It's all put in there, and it's all put in there very well. If you want a good novella, this is it. This is a good story. This will keep you on your toes, and it can also show that even if you have a high IQ, you can still be very foolish.
Indeed. All right. So once again, for folks who are interested in this story, you can pretty much find it anywhere. Any Lovecraft anthology will always have this story in it. It's one of the more his famous stories. And even though it's novella length, it's still short enough to be included in many collections. The story, once again, was written in 1930, released in 1931 for Weird Tales. It's generally, you actually probably could find it for free. I didn't bother looking since I have a copy of it, but a lot of his works you can pretty much find free on the internet, because a lot of it is in the public domain. Not all of it, but a good portion is. And also, as Kevin mentioned, both offline and I believe even here, you can find the audiobook easily everywhere, including just going to Yahoo and searching for the story on Yahoo. Yeah, that's what I meant to say. I'm sorry. YouTube, not Yahoo. On YouTube, just make sure you get the full story, because there's some that are cut off for some reason. They stop at 2.5 hours, while I think the story, if it's read out loud, is closer to 3.5 hours. So just make sure you get the whole story if you do listen to it on YouTube. But you also can get it right on any online bookstore and download it too for a cheap 99 cents or whatever, probably. So that's our topic for this month. We're planning to do another one next month, and since we had planned to do some of these stories earlier and never got to them because we discovered how long Lovecraft's short stories are, because quote-unquote they're not really short. What are our topics next month, Kevin?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but we are going to do Dagon and then Shadow over Innsmouth.
That's right. So we're going to do a combination of Dagon and Shadow over Innsmouth. The two stories are very linked together. Dagon is a fairly short story. It's only like 8 to 10 pages, and Innsmouth is closer to 30 or 35 or something. So we'll do them together as our next topic.
Double
we'll continue
feature.
The Lovecraft. Yep, double feature. So we'll continue the Lovecraft for at least another two book episodes before we switch over to some other stuff, most likely. But that's pretty much it. So I guess with all that stated, Barrett, why don't you lead us out?
Oh, I don't know the typical thing that we say. Abe knows that.
Give it a shot.
Abe, how about you then? Jump in for Barrett. Oh, yeah. There,
okay.
Give it a shot.
All right. Well, thank you for jumping in to listen as we talk about Whisper in the Darkness. Please join us next time when we finally get around to our next book episode. Don't worry. It'll be absolutely worth the wait. And please enjoy any of other episodes of the Dark Discussions podcast, and be sure to follow us on Facebook whenever if you want. If you want to check out the other podcasts there on our website, look on the right hand side, and there'll be plenty more goodies waiting for you. Until next time, folks.